It's fairly common in history to talk about famous people, great heroes, but there are also little heroes. Edwin Gray, who played a role in the savings and loan crisis, was just one of those little heroes and a member of a much maligned profession. Edwin Gray was a bureaucrat. In the northern hill country of Arkansas, near the university, near the Missouri country capital of Branson, John Paul Hammerschmidt ruled the congressional district from 1966, the first Republican elected in Arkansas in quite a long time, to 1993. A popular Republican in a solidly Republican pro-military district of northern Arkansas, Hammerschmidt often didn't even campaign for his seat. He stayed in Washington, or he raised money for other Republicans running for Congress around the country. But in one year, a Democrat named James McDougall would run against him. James McDougall was well-funded and had a unique strategy that no other Democrats had or could try before. In John Paul Hammerschmidt's career, only one Democrat had ever given him a scare of losing his seat. Only one could change the electoral map to an extent as to almost snatch from this conservative constituency its Republican seat and deliver it from the party of Lincoln to the party of Jackson. To turn the elephant to a donkey, one Democrat with boundless energy, charisma, good looks, and political know-how would give the plain state of Arkansas a fairly large shock and a piece of political legend. But James McDougall was not that Democrat. His strategy in the 1982 election was to buy every vote he could. And as the president of a looser, less regulated form of banking known as a savings and loan bank, he could. He was the president of Madison Guaranty Corporation and was in a unique position to loan and loan and loan some more money that ostensibly was not his to farmers, small businessmen, precinct captains, leaders of various towns, anyone who might control a few votes for him in that 82 election. By his own admission, he bought votes left and right. In the end, despite all his loaning and vote buying, McDougall got creamed. 34% of the vote. Not much worse than others, probably better than others who had run against Hammerschmidt. But not as good as the one Democrat who would give Hammerschmidt a shock in all his elections between 66 and 93. That man was a young University of Arkansas law professor named Bill Clinton. In 1974, the 25-year-old would come very close, within a few points, of beating Hammerschmidt. Now, 1974 was a big Democratic year, and Watergate helped, certainly. But so did Clinton's year of running through the local hillbilly counties in Hammerschmidt's district that he had never even gotten around to visit. Charming newspaper editors, local politicians, all along the way. Clinton lost that race, but for even getting that close, Clinton became a Democratic hero in Arkansas, a boy wonder. And at 27, he became the state's attorney general. And then, at 31, the youngest governor in the nation at the time. James McDougall was one of Clinton's supporters. And, like most of Northwest Arkansas, McDougall lent Bill and Hillary Clinton money, most notably $200,000 to buy property in Whitewater, a property that would collapse in value. When McDougall's defaulted loans and tax evasion schemes caught up with him, he agreed to testify against the Clintons for a lighter sentence. Only his own death in 1998 prevented this from happening. his Madison Guarantee Corporation, and the firm he hired to represent him, Hillary Clinton's Rose Law Firm, would be part of Arkansas legend and then national legend, and would follow Clinton into the White House and play a role in elections, eventually leading to the investigation that would lead to the Lewinsky affair and Clinton's House impeachment. This is the way in which even the Lewinsky affair and the impeachment of Clinton was related to that savings and loan crisis of the 1980s and early 1990s. Part of what allowed James McDougal to help this young Democratic governor and write loans to whomever he wanted for his congressional campaign was the political polar opposite in the White House, Republican President Ronald Reagan and his administration. But it started even earlier than that. Very early, really. Think about it. Alexander Hamilton introduced banking to the federal government of the United States. What if, he theorized, the federal government did more than just tax and then spend only what it collected, a cash-based system, just as if you were paid in cash and simply could only spend the money that was actually in your wallet or your bank account, but nothing else? What if instead of that, the new federal United States government assumed the debts of all of the states which they had incurred in the Revolutionary War, and then took that debt on, relieved the states of their debt, created bonds, and then sold the debt to others, wealthy individuals around the country? They could do that, as opposed to the 13 states. The federal government had the credibility of the world. This was a new United States, and there was a lot of faith in this new experiment in democracy. Faith that they could capitalize on, literally, by selling bonds. But further than that, what if you created a Bank of the United States that would collect the tax revenue the United States government was collecting from excise taxes, etc.? And instead of just merely collecting that money and spending it, they could, like any bank, lend against it, finance progress that the nation needed, roads, canals, new businesses. Hamilton wasn't all altruistic. He wasn't all patriotic, all forward-looking. The wealthy lawyers in New York who were his patrons, supporters, and clients owned New York State bonds, and they probably had little hope of those increasing in value, except to be sold to some entity, the United States government, perhaps. Still, Hamilton's assumption plan created a boom of sorts in the economy, right in the early years when the new government needed it most. And it certainly did much to make a poor nation a richer one, a nation capable of doing things for itself, building canals, building roads. And unlike the multiple state governments, a federal government bond was something that foreigners could sink their teeth into. Especially those wealthy Dutch, who, after all, had created banking, hadn't they? The old goldsmiths of Amsterdam. They were still active in the 1780s. They had helped finance our revolution, and they helped finance the new government of the United States. Savings and loans came out of a tradition of what was called building and loan banks, first in Britain, and then the concept came to the United States. It was a type of smaller, leaner bank that would only do home mortgages and building loans to finance real estate to help nations grow. And it was seen as a form of social progress. These were banks for working men to help get them into homes. They boomed and busted at different times in America the 19th century. After World War II, savings and loan or thrift banks offered servicemen coming home a better return on deposits and better mortgage rates than other banks could. But after the 1960s, they started to suffer from a variety of ills. And this will sound odd in a story that's often associated with deregulation. The first blow to hit the savings and loan industry was regulation. They were regulated as far as what they could pay out on deposits, especially when interest rates increased in the late 1970s. The first to help thrift banks was the Carter administration, which urged Congress to grant thrifts the power to make loans, some of the loans that banks can, most notably ADC loans, acquisition, development, and construction. So we're not just now savings and loans, we're not just making loans on existing home properties, but could buy land, develop the land, or construct a home. A little bit more risky type of loan, but still close to their original mission. The Federal Home Loan Banking Board, the FHLBB, the government agency that regulated these thrifts and loans, also increased the amount that thrift deposits were insured for, from $40,000 to $100,000, just like any other bank. Whereas before, a wealthy individual putting money into a savings and loan would have to either split the money between several banks in order to have it all insured or reduce the amount they put into thrifts. This increased the amount of money going to thrifts, but also increased taxpayer liability. And that change was done before President Reagan took office. This was done in the Carter administration. One other step that occurred during the Carter administration that helped the crisis along was that thrifts, or savings and loans, were allowed to get CDs from brokers. Brokers could be from around the country and would look for savings and loans anywhere that would give them the best rate. This set for a race to the bottom. Thrifts were offering higher and higher interest rates to get deposits in. These deposits had no loyalty to the local community. A wealthy individual in New York, for instance, could take their $100,000 and shop it around for the best interest rate. And why not? Whether they put their money in a bank in New York, a bank in Connecticut, a bank in New Jersey, a bank in Texas or California, their money was guaranteed by the federal government to the tune of $100,000. So it was just about getting the best interest rate. It was safe money. How did the thrifts, though, that bank, that savings and loan in Texas that was taking the $100,000, how did they pay for this very expensive money? Well, it might cost them 6 to 10% to get the money, but they would lend out the money at higher rates. How did they do that? By looking for riskier and riskier loans. This not only affected savings and loans, but also creeped into the regular banking industry, who was competing with the savings and loans. Most of this occurred during the Carter administration. When Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter on many issues, but one of them in particular being getting government out of people's lives, savings and loans were part of the growth of the West, an area that gave Reagan much of his electoral support. A good number of these thrifts were in Texas, California, Arizona, and Colorado. Treasury Secretary Donald Regan saw them as the cornerstone of business in the Reagan era. And the director of the Federal Home Loan Banking Board, Richard Pratt, saw no reason to regulate them and encouraged Congress to help them out. Congress, who also received generous contributions from this budding savings and loan industry, responded. Garn St. Germain, that legislation allowed savings and loans to raise rates, make consumer loans, and make commercial loans. Not only that, the amount of net worth that a savings and loan needed to have versus what they lent it out went from 5% to 3%. But even that belies the truth, because some of these net worth assets that they could show could be notes which were provided by the Treasury Department under Don Regan. A couple things made the situation even worse. Even the 3% net worth requirement, backed up in many cases by Don Regan's phony federal government notes, which could be considered assets to the bank, was phased in after 20 years, meaning that's okay. So if a savings and loan was around 20 years, they had to meet the 3% requirement. But those that hadn't been around 20 years yet could phase it in. So newer banks had even less requirements. states began to follow these new loose federal rules to avoid banks from leaving their charter and going and getting chartered in the federal government. In this environment, between state and federal loosening of regulation, 686 thrifts around the nation became 1,068. 500 new charters awarded in 4 years. On top of the lenient rules applied, even where they were violated by savings and loans, there were very few bank examiners on the case. Bank examiners worked directly for Don Regan and not for the board that was supposed to be regulating the industry, the FHLBB. And examiners were few in number and underpaid. As early as 1983, before anyone knew that there was a savings and loan crisis, 35% of the savings and loans bank were insolvent, even using the relaxed accounting standards that the Reagan administration allowed. These standards meant that they could loan all the money up front, including interest, and then show that money as income. This was called regulatory accounting practices versus GAAP, general accounting practices used by most corporations. So $1 million loaned out could garner $240,000 of interest to the bank, which they would collect in that first year, even though the interest was paid only from loan proceeds. What do these relaxed regulatory accounting procedures, or RAP, mean? It means that if I loaned you $200 and said you have 2 years to pay me $10 in interest, then I went to the bank and took out $210, handed you $200 and myself the $10. Then I reported that I received $10 in income. But I did not. 2 years have not passed. I have not yet collected that interest from you. Yet, here I am recording this $10 that I received only from taking money out of my own reserves. That's what banks did in order to inflate their own net earnings. And of course, borrowers didn't mind. They were getting a great loan at a good price for an investment too risky in many cases for most banks to do. The head of the bank board, Richard Pratt, didn't see any problem with the loosening of regulations of savings and loans. He saw it as a way of helping a sick industry. Probably more important than any other change that Congress or the administration made, the FHLBB under Pratt ended the requirement that SNLs have 400 local stockholders. This is what made them truly different from most banks. Now, in the 80s, one person could have complete control of a savings and loan. This, more than any other change, led to problems. Instead of having 400 members of the local community looking out for the health of the bank, one person could loot the bank. But after making these changes, Richard Pratt left for a lucrative job at Merrill Lynch, and an unknown assistant of Edwin Meese, who was Reagan's attorney general during his presidency and also during his governorship of California, person who had a small job in the White House, took over. His name was Edwin Gray, and Gray had served in a small policy job in the Reagan White House. Then he had gone home to San Diego, where he worked for a local savings and loan bank. As a Reagan loyalist, who was also in the thrift industry, the SNL industry was delighted to see him take the chair. He was, as Edwin Gray would admit, considered to be a patsy for the industry. And as Gray said, they didn't know me very well. But then again, I didn't know myself. Gray was appointed swiftly. However, when Gray learned of the problem with many of these new savings and loan banks as early as 1983, he proposed what was seen as a minor change. He wanted to at least prevent the brokered deposits from coming in. Now they could get deposits from the local community, but not put it out nationally so that it would be a race for the lowest bidder and for the most risky loans. Gray's idea made sense. Don Regan objected to it, as did the thrift industry. But still, Gray was able to get his changes through. Unfortunately, the courts overturned him. Regan complained that Gray was not a team player. But Regan also controlled the bank examiners who worked for his department and weren't working quick enough. Gray tried to get OMB examiners to report to him, not to Regan. For this, he was called a re-regulator by David Stockman, Reagan's budget chief. Re-regulator was one of the biggest insults in the pro-business Reagan administration. In 1983, when Gray first noticed something was wrong with savings and loan, the SNL problem, it is estimated, might have been fixed for a mere $9.5 billion. Gray was not against regulation completely. He gave, for example, the airlines, where he would favor some deregulation. But savings and loan were not the airlines. They were an industry backed by the taxpayers for their losses. If an airline loses money, it's not paid by Joe Public. If a thrift loses money, its depositors are fully insured. By 1986, two factors further swayed savings and loans in their decline. One was low energy prices, damning developments in some of the states where they were growing the most, Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma. And then the 1986 Tax Reform Act limited how much money could be written off from investments in real estate. This dropped the values of real estate. At this point, in 1986, had the problem been stopped, the solution was estimated at $80 billion. Gray made many attempts to see President Reagan to discuss the objections to what was going on with savings and loan. He was not brought in to President Reagan, and therefore Reagan could claim he was not aware of the problem. But Reagan wasn't the only one that stood in Gray's way. Majority Leader and future Speaker Jim Wright blocked anything having to do with savings and loans, who were among his best customers and big donors to Wright and the Democratic Congress. But surely the most famous interference occurred in April 1987 in the office of Senator Dennis DeConcini of Arizona. Present were his fellow senator in the state, John McCain, Alan Cranston, Democrat of California, Dan Riegel, Democrat of Michigan, and John Glenn of Ohio. Charles Keating was a contributor to all of the five, a business partner of John McCain's wife and a personal friend of hers. And Alan Cranston used the money from Lincoln's savings to bankroll a $100,000 turnout drive in California. The senators met with Keating and then met with the bank examiners who were looking at Lincoln savings and loan. They asked the regulators to slow down the investigation. For the bank regulators, the meeting with five senators, senators being among the most powerful people in Washington, was uncomfortable, to say the least. Later, when the examiners told the senators that they were close to filing criminal charges against Keating, the senators, except for Cranston, backed off. Cranston still kept helping Keating even after the criminal charges were filed. The media covered the meeting with the five senators as early as 1987, but it was not until 1989, when the SNL crisis had really reached the consciousness of the public, that the Keating Five became a household name. Cranston was reprimanded by the Senate Ethics Committee for his actions. During the time that Keating was influencing senators, Gray was fighting a lonely battle within the administration, trying to see President Reagan, trying to get bank examiners that worked for the Office of Management and Budget controlled by Don Regan, the Treasury Secretary, to work for him, to get closer to the banks that they were examining to see what they were doing, the type of investments they were putting their money in. Frustrated, Gray would eventually hire his own bank examiners out of his own budget funds. He would earn the wrath of both the Democratic Congress and the Republican administration. Don Regan would see that reporters were leaked unfavorable information about Gray. And President Reagan appointed a Keating loyalist named Lee Hinkle to the FHLBB board in order to outvote Gray and represent the thrift industry better. Hinkle only lasted 6 months until it was revealed that he was regulating banks that he had ownership shares in. Republican friends of Gray told him he was now persona non grata. One of his friends in California, who had been a lifelong friend prior, saw Gray ruining the party's relationship with the thrift industry, which was the main source of campaign funds for the Republican Party. In 1987, Gray's term as chairman of the FHLBB expired, and he was not renominated. President Reagan replaced him with a pro-thrift deregulation advocate. In 1988, as Michael Dukakis battled Vice President George Bush for the presidency, Democrats barely raised the savings and loan issue in that election. How could they? So many Democrats were forceful supporters of the thrift industry and relied on their funds for their campaigns. Jim Wright, Speaker of the House and chair of the convention in Atlanta in 1988, was one of the thrift's biggest advocates. Upon taking office, President Bush formed the Resolution Trust Corporation to resolve the now hundreds of insolvent SNLs with funds guaranteed by taxpayers. Although the Resolution Trust Corporation attempted to sell some of the insolvent thrift's assets, a lot of investments that had no worth anymore, only about $9 billion was raised. The cost to the taxpayers was nearly $160 billion. Between taxpayer funds of 130 appropriated by Congress, and the remainder a tax on the thrift industry, really a tax on the healthy savings and loans who hadn't participated in some of the activities the insolvent ones had. We might think that the amount spent on the savings and loan crisis has been dwarfed by what we've spent on TARP in 2008. $700 billion. It's a big number. That's the money appropriated. Now, not all of that has been spent, and some of the funds have been returned. Some have gone to the auto industry and to prop up the commercial paper markets. But at least about $450 billion has been spent on banks. Doing a value of money comparison to 1991, the $160 billion is at least $235 billion today by Consumer Price Index standard. By blue-collar workers' buying power, it's about $250. If you use share of GDP comparison 1991 to 2008, you've got at least $350 billion. Pretty close to today's damage. And there's a key difference. The money spent on the savings and loan crisis is gone. That was spent to guarantee deposits at a group of insolvent banks. Money's gone. Those banks don't exist anymore. With TARP, since some of the money was used to buy bank shares, there's at least the hope that in the future, the large banks will pay back. And since they are still solvent entities, perhaps they'll be taxed on in the future, or that they'll return some assets, you know, or the assets in the form of bank shares might inflate in value. There is still one remaining chapter to the savings and loan crisis, and that is that the Resolution Trust Corporation forced some healthy and insolvent banks to merge in order to save some of the banks and stop the bleeding a bit. In 1996, the Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional, and there are thousands of pending lawsuits regarding these goodwill cases. Some of them could reach up to $6 billion. We really don't know how many of them will settle favorably. And Edwin Gray? Not surprisingly, Gray had trouble getting a job in government. He was persona non grata in the Republican Party. There was no position for him in the new Bush administration. He also had trouble with some of his friends in the private sector. Eventually, Gray became the president of a Miami thrift bank, and he was actually had to step down from that after a few years. It's difficult to find information about Edwin Gray. He's in a few pages of books about Reagan. Googling him, except for some mentions during the savings and loan crisis, it's not there. The battle of a bureaucrat, it seems, is a hidden one. What lessons are there in the savings and loan crisis, the large expenditure of money in the early 1990s that we seem to have learned so little from? One is it's just one more example, as an 1819, as in 1857, as in 1873, and 2008 of overspeculation and overeasy credit, leading to a crash that would also trigger a recession. In almost every case, it seems to happen. So being aware of any future speculative bubbles and saying, might be a takeaway. It's also, I think, an individual story. We talk so much about bureaucrats being horrible people. They're holding up progress. But in this case, a bureaucrat, not only Gray is the chairman of the FHLBP, but his examiners that work tirelessly with little resources to try to stem the problem. We're advocating the right thing, but the elected politicians benefiting from the type of fundraising that thrifts could do. Why not? It wasn't their money. Elected politicians shut it down. And as with many scandals, this was a bipartisan effort, Republicans and Democrats. Who represents people when both parties are in collusion? Who does the right thing? Gray made a distinction between taxpayer-supported industry and non-taxpayer-supported industries, where he could allow deregulation. A more complex, rather than ideological, approach might have assisted. The snowball of credit, speculation, and then triggering donations to politicians and economic growth in their districts makes it impossible to expect elected politicians to be the future guards against these type of crises. So what do we do? What do we do when faced with such a large expansion of credit that we just can see is going to fall out with huge expense to taxpayers and probably to our economy? Some new legislation is probably the answer, and that's being advocated today with the current banking crisis. But legislation can be easily repealed by Congress, just as easily can be enacted. It's not useless because it does take a vote in order to repeal it, and there's some questioning at the time. But it's fairly easy to repeal. We repealed Glass-Steagall, which came out of the 30s. Carter Glass, Virginia senator, wanted to separate banks from the investment business. We repealed that in the late 90s under the Clinton administration. Banks got involved in investments, and that helped, among many other factors, to propel the 2008 crisis. We can rely on regulators, but the problem is regulators still work for the government, and the government is in the hands of, and the government's run by Congress. The government's run by Congress and the administration. We can give the power to stop excessive speculation to the president. Now, in the 1980s, under President Reagan, this obviously would not have worked well, but in other cases it might. The members of the Constitutional Convention saw the president, saw the chief executive, as one person who could take control when the body of Congress was just responding to, you know, not what the right thing was to do, but to what people wanted in the short term. The president was somebody who could look out for the national interest. So giving the president the lever to then say, to veto aggressive speculation in the market, to veto some of the regulatory rules, only in the negative and not in the positive. In other words, the president can veto it, but not open it up more. That would have to be a vote of Congress. Could assist, assuming, though, that the right individual's in the presidency. Easier for one man to make that determination. The more successful examples in history have been independent entities, or quasi-independent entities. Have the Federal Reserve System, which controls interest rates. Every president wants low interest rates. Federal Reserve manages that process. And while they're not completely independent, a six-year term is a long time for governor of the Board of the Federal Reserve. The Base Closing Commission. Here's an example of a commission that handles a process that nobody in Congress wants, which is to close bases. It's independent. Still has to report to Congress. It still faces some pressures, but it does a much better job of managing an uncomfortable process that nobody likes, but has to be done. In effect, what you need is a form of an economic Supreme Court. Somebody who's appointed long terms, who can examine a situation in the middle of a speculative bubble and perhaps stop the process. This is a more general statement, I realize, and I don't have all the specifics of legislation, but it's the type of things politicians should be thinking now. There's a lot of talk now about regulations, whether there'll even be just a simple new regulations on bank from the Congress. But in the midst of a speculative period, those regulations could be thrown out the window. Harder to dissolve a board, not impossible, harder. There's a few other ideas. One would be, we hope, to rely on the media a little bit more, to watch out for these type of situations before they happen. Not only the official media, but the blogs. And probably last, there's a simple measure. Anytime a new regulation is voted, perhaps you can require Congress to write into the legislation how much the bailout would be if it goes south. To make an estimate, maybe the GAO makes an estimate, and perhaps even force Congress to bond money towards a bailout. That would make the decision to hit the gas pedal on deregulation a little bit harder to do. I want to thank you for listening. The website's MyHistoryCanBeatUpYourPolitics.com. Thank you to those who have purchased the archive of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. Lots of good stuff there. It is $9.99, special recession price. MyHistoryCanBeatUpYourPolitics.com. Thanks very much.